Welcome back to Dakota Midday from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. Some symbols immediately evoke awareness for a cause. A pink ribbon bumper sticker reminds people of the battle against breast cancer. The red dress pin lends its image easily to heart health for women, but it's harder to identify a cultural symbol for mental health. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and SDPB's Keely Boutine introduces two people willing to reveal how they ensure mental illness doesn't define their lives.
It's not new information. The National Institute of Mental Health says one in four adults has a mental illness. The number is considerable, and it's a fact. But the statistic can also be the easy way out, because examining only the numbers stops people from looking too deeply into what it means to live with mental illness. John Baxter wants to change that.
I can talk to somebody and be very professional and get my message across, and they'd never know. But yet, I have to deal with fallout for when I go through my bad episodes and I make a fool out of myself and I cause problems. And if somebody meets me during that time, you know, they're not going to have a high opinion of me.
The Sioux Falls man is a college graduate. Baxter volunteers. He's a trainer for peer mental health support groups.
I have schizoaffective disorder, and I have a pretty significant form of it. I really deal with it. I really struggle. I'm a little more severe probably than your average person.
As with any illness, different people have different experiences with schizoaffective disorder. But Baxter tries to describe how his illness can literally hijack his life.
When I get sick, I get very, very sick. I can be very, very well and very, very articulate. And then I can go through a time. Usually what happens is I start to get really happy. And then the next thing you know, I'm in trouble and in Yankton or in jail somewhere. And I wake up and it's like, what's happened? How did I get in trouble? It's like I can't remember this big span of time.
Baxter says his years of living with schizoaffective disorder have mellowed him. He handles uncomfortable situations with more grace now, and he sometimes feels a problem coming on and finds the right people to get him help. Penny Hall says that self-awareness doesn't magically happen for people, at least not for her. Hall first heard her diagnosis in 1993, but she began dealing with the problem 6 years later. She calls it a process of acceptance.
I have a mental illness. I am not bipolar. I have bipolar. And so it doesn't define me as a person today, so I'm not afraid to talk about it anymore.
Hall explains she tends toward the more depressive facet of the disease formerly known as manic depressive disorder.
When I'm really down, I isolate, I have bad hygiene, I don't want to talk to people, I don't want to be responsible, or I'm not responsible, you know, I don't keep my commitments, I just want to throw the covers over my head and call it a day. But when I'm healthy, I get up in the morning, you know, I take care of myself physically, I take care of myself spiritually.
She goes to her appointments, meets with mental health professionals, and works at her part-time job. Hall says she didn't always possess the audacity to push forward.
I didn't know what people would think of me. You know, having a mental illness, I didn't know if I would ever be loved. You know, I thought maybe people would be afraid of me.
Hall says her acceptance of bipolar disorder as part of her existence, one she doesn't get to choose, eases most people's nerves. She and John Baxter have vastly different illnesses, but some of their strength comes from the same source, support from family and friends. Baxter says finding the courage to live a fulfilling life doesn't mean never questioning.
And I don't think there's anyone with a disability that doesn't wonder, what would my life have been if I would have never had this arm missing? Or what would my life have been if I would have been able to walk? I often wonder what my life would have been if this disease hadn't crippled me when I was 22 years old.
Baxter is grounded in his work with others who live with mental illness, who need an outlet for their wonder and fear and hurt and happiness in anonymous group settings. Penny Hall talks to crowds about her time living with mental illness.
When I go out and tell my story, there's successes, hopes, and dreams. And at the end, obviously, the hopes is to reach one person, to let them know that they're not alone. We're out there, and we're there for you. We just don't want you to feel alone anymore.
Hall says no one is really alone, and if she can handle what life's thrown at her, she believes others can flourish too. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Keely Boltina in Sioux Falls.
And you're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. For more on the subject of mental illness, I'm joined by two health professionals. Wendy Giebink is Executive Director at NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Health Illness, South Dakota. And Craig Kindred is Manager of the Avera Behavioral Health Services Addiction Recovery Program. They're joining the program from the SDPB studios at the University of Sioux Falls. And Wendy Giebink and Craig Kindred, thanks so much for joining us on Dakota Midday.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting us.
Well, we just heard that report from Keeley. How closely do the stories we just heard reflect those of others who are dealing with mental illness? Craig?
Well, I think we're making progress with stigma and awareness. So I think more people perhaps are reaching out for help, which is a good thing. And that's perhaps the essence of a program like this today. On the other hand, I think we have a lot of room for improvement, too.
Wendy, are you finding that, you know, even if there is room for improvement, that as awareness continues, that maybe some of the stigmas about mental illness are starting to decrease somewhat?
You know, I really hope so. That's one of the major components of what we do at NAMI is educating the public and educating people who live with mental illnesses and their families, about all the facts and trying to dispel those myths for people. So because we really believe that if we can reduce that stigma and reduce the ignorance that people have about mental health conditions, we'll just be that much farther ahead in getting people the treatment that they need and deserve.
Are there some common myths that are out there that just you're still struggling to try to deal with the general public?
Yeah, some of them are just maybe that generational idea that everybody should be able to solve their own problems, and you know, if you're depressed, just get up and go to work and deal with it like everybody else. Or, you know, if you are anxious, just count to 10 or something, like take some deep breaths and you'll be fine. But for people with a biological based brain disorder, it's not as simple as that. And so oftentimes even people who live with folks that are having these symptoms don't understand. And so people will face maybe the harshest criticism within their own families.
Well, Craig Kindred, before we continue the discussion more, I think we should at least stop and maybe define a little bit about mental illness. What is it? Is it biological? Are there different degrees of mental illness? When we're talking about mental illness, what is it?
Well, I think it's important to recognize there's a continuum or a spectrum when we're talking about mental health issues or mental illness. And perhaps some myths or beliefs or facts are not properly understood or represented when we look at receiving care. Some people might look at a severe example of mental illness, and that keeps them from reaching out for help because they're pretty functional. But yet their unaddressed mental health issue might be compromising the quality of their life. So there is a spectrum, and there are some that have more biological or genetic components to their condition than others. You can have different strengths of DNA or vulnerability or susceptibility to conditions. Sometimes they get hidden behind other consequences, such as substance use gets attention, but maybe the underlying mental health thing gets overlooked. You might have things surface in young adulthood when people are off to university and there's stress there and things get activated and bubble up. And of course, substance use can be prevalent on college campuses. And so there's many, many things that can interfere.
Is there anything that all mental illnesses have in common?
Well, NAMI believes that, what we say is that mental illnesses are medical conditions. And, you know, they tend to disrupt a person's thinking, feeling, mood, ability to relate to other people, and sometimes their daily functioning. And it's important to remember, we think, that, you know, these are medical illnesses and medical conditions, and that they are highly treatable. Many people tend to just focus on the medical aspect of, well, you know, if I have a mental illness, I will have to take drugs for the rest of my life, and I'm afraid of that. Well, you know, first of all, there are many, many different medications now than there used to be in the past, and so sometimes those fears are not well-founded, but also there are other treatments that come into play with the psychosocial treatments, therapies and, you know, group dynamic type things, just, you know, even healthy living choices. We're finding out about how diet affects our brain functioning and the right amount of sleep and consistency of our sleep and our activities, and having a support network, people to talk to. All of those things go into a successful treatment plan for most people that would have a mental health disorder. And so, you know, it's important to look at all of those things as well.
We were talking earlier about the perception among the general public on mental illness. Craig Kindred, continuing with what Wendy was just talking about, it sounds like that mental health professionals, that the medical world is changing as well in how the different options as far as treatment of mental illness and understanding of what causes it.
Yes, I think one thing, technology has allowed perhaps more research and development of medicine fine-tuned to the individual. I mean, very individualistic forms of care can be outlined with proper consultation. Right now, there's a lot of research into genetics to see what medicines might work right out of the gate for the initial care of a person with a mental health condition. I liked Wendy's points, too, of the holistic approach, not just looking for all the answer in a medicine. There's cognitive, behavioral, social elements, group support, so on, can be extremely valuable. And then I also think many people are reluctant to seek consultation or help for their condition because what we get comfortable with for a long enough period of time becomes our normal, and normal's not always healthy. And so those are just a few points I'd add.
In that situation, what is the responsibility of family members, perhaps, if they see someone in the family, whether it's a spouse or a son or a daughter, when see that maybe there's some symptoms there that they should perhaps seek treatment, find out what's going on. What is the role there of the family? I mean, particularly if you're dealing with maybe someone who's older than 18.
You know, family is maybe overlooked, I think, sometimes, even by clinicians. And the family's role is so very important. And, you know, when we're looking at mental illnesses, very often they will have their beginnings in a young person. We look at the population of the, you know, that teenage population. 20% of youth ages 13 to 18 are going to have a mental, you know, health disorder or symptoms in any given year. But our youth tend to be undiagnosed or underdiagnosed because we think, and I know this in my own case, in my family, you think, well, they're just being teenagers. You know, that's within the normal spectrum of teenage behavior. And sometimes things are, but sometimes they warrant further investigation by the parent and even for younger children as well. If there's something that you're concerned about, you know, you start with your child's pediatrician, you start with the doctor and say, here's some things I'm wondering about. Is this normal? Is this okay? Talk to teachers. And it is a parent's responsibility to you know, seek help for their child's mental health conditions as well as their physical health conditions, but they can be very confusing for families. And so that's why, you know, it's really important that we continue to reach out to families and give them that education that they need so that they are aware of, you know, what are some of these warning signs and what are some of the things that I can do as a parent. You know, years ago, we used to blame mental illness on parents. And so sometimes parents will have a reluctance to even bring things up because they're afraid they're going to be blamed for things. And, you know, that needs to be a thing of the past.
Is it becoming more of a thing of the past?
I hope so. I mean, yeah. I can see myself, you know, in my own family 15, 16 years ago, parents were blamed and not given much education at all. And, you know, I can very much relate to that situation, but I think now it's becoming more common. Maybe some clinicians, you know, even pediatricians and family practitioners are learning more about mental illness and finding more ways to refer their younger patients at an earlier stage and give parents, you know, that empower them with more education and more tools that they can use.
You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. This is Mental Health Awareness Month, and we're talking with Wendy Giebing. She's Executive Director at NAMI, National Alliance of Mental Health South Dakota, and Craig Kindred, who is Manager of the Avera Behavioral Health Services Addiction Recovery program. And Craig Kindred, one of the things that you touched on a little bit was, I guess, what you call co-occurring issues where there's mental illness along with perhaps some substance abuse. Is it easy to tell what comes first, whether it's the abuse of alcohol or drugs or the mental illness that it's sort of a you're trying to treat it on your own with alcohol and other drugs?
Well, I think for the sake of time, I will say sometimes people get too excessively hung up on that question. If they're both there, they both need to be assessed properly. They both need to be treated properly. One affects the other, and so. Thankfully, in this day of age of care, you referenced the term co-occurring. That is a friendlier marriage of what used to be called dual diagnosis. The fact of the matter is it should be looked at. Not everybody has it with co-occurring. Conservatively speaking, adults in North America, about one out of two with a mental health issue, will have also an element of substance use disorder or condition at some point in their life as well, or co-occurring alongside it when they seek mental health care. It's here to stay. I'm thankful for the fact that language is out there because we don't necessarily need to have clarity about what caused what. If it's both there, let's look at it thoroughly. And it can be confusing, and obviously finding practitioners who are credentialed in both areas, ideally under the same roof, can be very valuable.
We have this. We see this message on our Facebook page. Might be worth commenting on. I'm 63 on Social Security, uninsured. I have no medical coverage. The pre-existing condition was alcohol treatment that set me up for continued denials for coverage at various workplaces. In the meantime, there are 3 heart attacks and a load of debt. And the comment is, who wouldn't be depressed in this situation? Does this Craig Kindred, perhaps raise the issue of some of the difficulties in treating and dealing with mental illness and all the different causes that are going on at the same time?
Well, I think it's very unfortunate what the fellow described there. And there are barriers. And that's what this program's about, is trying to remove some barriers, increase some awareness that men may benefit from visiting with someone about options and strategies that could be utilized to help him with his challenges there about lack of access to health care or challenges with employment and so forth. So, for the sake of time, I would say there are some options, and perhaps some people in facing these challenges or barriers might be unaware of those without consulting with an agency or a practitioner or clinic or so forth.
And I would just kind of just jump in on that too, and part of this is caused by stigma, in people living with mental illness and the people that live with them, employers and family and friends. And, you know, we've kind of allowed stigma to make people feel hopeless about their conditions. And, I don't think it is a hopeless situation. Most of these are not hopeless, but people have become so used to their situation and being told no that they sometimes stop reaching out. And so we would always want to encourage people to keep reaching out and to not lose hope, and to sometimes you have to be your own advocate or find someone to advocate for you. But there are treatments out there. There is help out there. There are people that live with the same types of things you do that are willing to talk with you too and help you realize you're not alone. That's one of the most important issues in recovery for both mental illness and substance abuse, is the knowledge that you're not the only person going through these things.
And to tap into that, it can be overwhelming, because here you are dealing with these challenges and it can be complicated about what my options might be. So that can be value to consulting, even on a no-charge basis. There are resources in various communities that you can reach out to and let them help you simplify your awareness of what could be done. Let them help you get linked with the right forms of care and so forth. So it might feel hopeless, but it really isn't hopeless. There are resources out there. Sometimes it's just overwhelming, so it keeps people from asking for help.
Well, before I let you go, we're talking about resources. Is there like a quick, easy one place where people can at least get started in finding places to find those resources?
Well, I would suggest the NAMI South Dakota as one resource because we're tapped into community mental health centers across the state. And our number is 271-1871. In Sioux Falls is a 605 number. We also have our website, which is namisouthdakota.org. People can go to that and find some help in their communities. We are in 9 communities in South Dakota. But also, you know, start with your doctor and start with your, you know, whoever your practitioner is and be honest and say, these are the things I'm concerned about and I'm needing help with housing or whatever. And, you know, just talk to the people that you already know, but please reach out to the rest of us. And then I also want to tell you that we're having a really big gathering of people who care about mental health in Sioux Falls this Saturday at 9:30 in the morning, but we're having check-in at 8:30 at Saratoma Park. It's the 11th annual NAMI Walks. There will be lots of people there who live with mental illness and their family members and friends and people who just care about the issue. And we also have 6 informational tables from agencies across the region that can help with some of these issues. And so they're available for you to come and talk there as well. And, you know, please just come and celebrate with us the fact that we are now in an era where we're talking about mental health as part of the human experience, and it's okay to talk about. So we would love to have people come out and be with us Saturday morning at Saratoma Park.
And Craig, anything from you as far as resources that people can check out?
Well, sure. You know, as Wendy said, NAMI's there, easy to access. But every local community has typically a mental health, core mental health center. If you're in a real smaller community, they often have satellites. But otherwise, there's the internet. Just Google mental health services and location. Of course, within Avera McKinnon and Avera Behavioral Health, we have numerous options. You can go to AveraBehavioralHealth.org. We'll give you a number of different options for contacting for more information. We have an assessment program, no charge assessment, 322-4065, 605, 322-4065. And our outpatient office that has about 25 clinicians, we can be a clearinghouse for information from just an inquiry from a member of the community, and that's 605-322-4079.
All right. Well, Craig Kindred, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us on Dakota Midday.
Thank you.
And Wendy Giebink, thanks for your time as well.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Wendy Giebink is Executive Director of NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness, South Dakota. Craig Kindred, Manager of the Avera Behavioral Health Services Addiction Recovery Program. This is Mental Health Awareness Month, and once again, the annual NAMI Walks South Dakota takes place at Saratoma Park in Sioux Falls on Saturday. The check-in is 8:30 in the morning. The walk raises funds for NAMI's education and support programs. For more details on that, you can visit our website at sdpb.org. You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Coming up after a short break, we'll talk with a New York author who says Italian sculptor Luigi Del Bianco deserves greater recognition for his work in the carving of Mount Rushmore.